Welcome to Inside the Writer's Cafe, brought to you on webtalkradio.net. I'm Cheryl Nason, and this is a show about books and the people who write them. Our topics for this week's show are personal skill development and business success. New York Times columnist Paul Sullivan focuses on the issue of why some people excel under pressure and others don't in his fascinating new book, Clutch, published by Portfolio, the business imprint of Penguin. Paul Sullivan has a degree in history from Trinity College and the University of Chicago. Currently, he writes the Wealth Matters column for the New York Times. His articles have appeared in Condé Nast Portfolio, the International Herald Tribune, Barron's, the Boston Globe, and Food and Wine. He's also been a reporter, editor, and columnist at the Financial Times. He's joining us today to talk about his new book, Clutch, Why Some People Excel Under Pressure and Others Don't. Paul, what a pleasure. Welcome to Inside the Writer's Cafe.
Thanks, Cheryl. Thanks for having me on today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You got me from the title of the book. I mean, when I saw the way the book cover looked and I read the title, I thought, what is this? I flipped it open and started to read, and I thought, I have to talk to Paul Sullivan. So I'm pleased.
That's just what I want to hear. We're off to a great start.
Good, good, good. Let's tell our listeners, they may be sitting there thinking, what? Let's tell them a little bit about what Clutch is about, and then let's talk about some specifics, because the book's just fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, the initial idea for the book came to me, you know, 2007, 2008, when I watched, you know, like everyone else was, otherwise bright people make horrible decisions under pressure. And, you know, I started joking with some friends of mine, saying, you know, hey, you know, remember those times we've played golf? And they said, oh, yeah, Paul, you were, you know, a horrendous choker. And we had a good laugh. And then I started thinking about it, you know, when I choke on the golf course, it may be frustrating to me, but it doesn't matter. When, you know, somebody running a bank, somebody, you know, commanding a battalion, when, you know, somebody, you know, in a courtroom chokes under pressure, it has serious ramifications. And, you know, as a lifelong sports fan, I know that we all want to root for the clutch player, and deep down we want to be clutch ourselves. And so that was really the initial idea behind the book. And, you know, over the years of writing it, it expanded a bit, but it really, I wanted to answer that question, you know, why are some seemingly smart people better under pressure than others who seem just as smart?
And, you know, the thing that I like about the book, too, is that you have pulled stories. I mean, you have stories not only from the sports world, and I think we can talk about clutch. One of the things I loved in the book was the very beginning where you give four examples and you say, okay, if you really think you know what clutch is, which one of these four examples really works? And there are two of them that actually do, and I'm not going to say which two. But I liked that, and I think that we can recognize clutch. It's one of those, sometimes I call them squishy words, where we know it when we see it. But how do you define that when you're really looking at clutch? And you have examples from sports, you have examples from business, and you also have, I was stunned to find, an example from the arts and theater. How do you define clutch?
Yeah, I great question. I define it as the ability to do what you can do under normal circumstances, under extreme pressure. And that's important to me because it's not luck, you know, and thank you for not giving away the examples at the beginning of the book. But, you know, the two that aren't clutch, I believe, involve a tremendous amount of luck. And, you know, as I started off, I mean, you're absolutely right. We know what clutch means. We know it when we see it, and we see it a lot in sports, or we see its opposite in sports. We see choking. But, you know, just as when I choked playing golf, that ultimately didn't matter to me. It may have ruined my day, but it didn't matter. And just as if our favorite football team or baseball team chokes going down the stretch, it may be frustrating to us, but it doesn't ultimately matter. I wanted to take this term that we're all familiar with and take it away from sports and apply it, as you said, to areas of our lives that have, you know, much more relevance. I mean, how are we, you know, doing under the pressure of our jobs? How are we doing under the pressure of, you know, our hobbies? I mean, the acting example is, you know, the actor, essentially what he's talking about in that chapter of my book is stage fright. So think of all the times people have to get up and give presentations and how, you know, some of them do a great job, but others who may know more than that person who does a great job choke under the pressure. You know, even, you know, I've talked to groups of stay-at-home moms about this, about how they can get better under the pressure of taking care of their families. And so what my goal was to, you know, identify, you know, talk to top performers, you know, across a range of professions and identify the common traits of those who were clutch and then work to see how we could apply those traits to parts of our lives that would be very relevant to us.
What role does discipline play in being clutch?
Discipline is, you know, they identify five traits. The first is focus. The second is discipline. The third is adaptability. The fourth is being present. And the fifth is what I call the push and pull of fear and desire. So, you know, nothing in the book, nothing can happen without focus, without your ability to sort of be there and to think only on the task at hand. But the second most important one is discipline. And, you know, I describe it quite simply as the battle of you against yourself. And one of the examples I give in that chapter of the book is about this psychiatrist named Ari Kiev, who in the 1970s was named psychiatrist to the U.S. Olympic Committee. So he was brought in to deal with, you know, top athletes. But in the 1970s, athletes didn't want to go to a psychiatrist. I mean, there was still a stigma against it. You know, only crazy people go to psychiatrists. That, you know, peak performance wasn't really understood. And so Ari Kiev had this job, but he didn't really have anybody to work with. And so finally, the riflery team, some guys from the riflery team came up to him and said, you know, we have a question for you. Why can we shoot perfectly well in practice, but not in competition? And this to him was a perfect scenario in which to talk about discipline, because there's a control. I mean, it's not like a football game in which somebody's going to run after you. It's not, you know, you're not playing in a stadium where the fans could have an influence one way or the other. I mean, shooting a rifle in practice is exactly the same as shooting a rifle in competition. Nothing changes. The range is the same. Nobody's yelling at you. You've got a gun, so nobody's charging at you. You don't have to worry about that. But what Kiev found after studying these guys was it was simply they started to breathe differently when they were in competition. So he worked on their discipline, and he got them to a point where they would shoot between breaths. And as soon as they did that, their performance picked right up, and they were shooting almost as well in competition as they were in practice. And that was wholly due to their ability to discipline themselves, to sort of win that battle against themselves.
Now, I know somebody out there is thinking exactly what you address in your book. They're thinking, well, wait a minute, what's the difference between discipline and concentration? Because on the surface, they sound like they could be the same thing, but they're not.
Yeah, and I draw that. It's a great question. I address it all the time in talks. And the way I look at it is I draw the parallel between concentration and focus. And the easiest way to think about it is concentration is a flashlight. Focus is a laser beam.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I mean, concentration is driving your car home on the highway tonight. Focus is driving a Ferrari on a racetrack at 200 miles an hour, and by the way, it's not your Ferrari.
Wow, what a great analogy. I really like that, because that makes it, that brings it home to something I can identify with and understand. Focus is really a linchpin, isn't it?
Exactly. Yep, and it's really sets the person up for everything else that they're going to have to do under pressure.
So it's almost a cascade. Once I learn really how to focus, and then I bring the other discipline and adapting and fear and desire, I bring all of those things into play. But focus has to come first.
That's right. Yep, it's like gravity on the earth. Without it, things don't work.
Well, what about adapting? Now, some people will say, wait a minute, that isn't that just giving in? Isn't that just sort of rolling with the punches? But it's really not.
No, it's not, and it's why it's, you know, the third trait after discipline, because discipline is going to keep you from being wishy-washy, from rolling with the punches. You know, adaptability is really, you know, when you have a plan in place and something forces you to change it. For example, one of the fellows I talked to in the book, the Secret Service agent, and, you know, the Secret Service model is for nothing to ever happen, and they do everything they possibly can to prevent anything from happening when they're protecting somebody. And the fellow I talked to in 92, he was guarding Bill Clinton when Bill Clinton was running for president. And they're in California, and they're on a rope line. And, you know, as we all know, you know, President Clinton likes to talk to people. He likes to get in the crowd and impress the flesh and chat away. And they had it all pretty contained. I mean, that was their plan. Their plan was, okay, he's going to walk here to there, and, you know, a dozen Secret Service agents around him, we have this covered. But, of course, I wouldn't be telling this story if it worked out that way. And, you know, after doing his rope line, you know, then Governor Clinton decides he wants to go talk to some more people. Well, this isn't quite what the Secret Service had planned, but they were able to adapt, you know, their structure around him, except one of the people he goes to talk to decides to grab his hand and hold on to him and try to pull him into the crowd.
Wow.
Now, the Secret Service agent I talked to was the number one agent that day, which means number one is always next to the person who's being protected. And he told me, he says, you know, it's not possible, but the only thing I heard was Clinton telling me he won't let go. And within 15 seconds, this agent had broken the person's hand in the crowd, broken his hand, dropped the guy to the ground, and, you know, agents two and three get behind him, and they all start to push Clinton into the SUV. You know, four, five, and six jump on the guy, seven, eight, and nine fan out into the crowd, and everything is so well orchestrated to adapt in that moment of pressure. And it's just incredible. And, you know, when this agent is telling me this story, I was totally wrapped up in it. And my first question to him was, you know, what happened to the guy? You know, what
exactly
happened to the guy?
I'm sitting here thinking, exactly.
He broke. Like, what happened to the guy? And he pauses, and he looks at me like I'm the dumbest person he's ever encountered. And he says, I don't know, and I don't care.
Wow.
That wasn't part of the plan. You know, when the plan changed, this agent adapted. He knew that every other agent would fall in behind him, and they all had their job to do. And, you know, that's why the Secret Service system works so well. That, of course, is an extreme example, and most of us aren't going to have to do that in our lives. But, you know, think of the difference, you know, in a simple way. If you're standing in a bar and it's not crowded, you're going to walk in a straight line to the bar to get a drink. But if there are, you know, 60 people in that room, you're going to have to adapt your plan. You're going to have to, you know, weave around and walk through. I mean, that's essentially, you know, we do it intuitively. We adapt intuitively in our daily lives. Where we often fall short is when we're under pressure, because we lose that focus, that discipline, and of course we can't adapt as we should.
And of course, in my mind, I saw that scene happen exactly the way that you described it. You're a journalist, and you have a way with words. And I'm thinking about this poor guy with a broken hand who's going, what just happened to me? You know?
He was going to jail. That's what was about to happen to him. But, and after he got out of jail, then he'd be – that was a bad idea.
No kidding. Don't not let go of someone. That was amazing. That's a great story. You know, there are five, and what's the next one? We've talked about focus. We've talked about discipline. We've talked about adapting.
Yep.
What's the fourth one?
The being present. I mean, and I touched on that in the beginning. That's the you know, I tell it through the story of this actor who, he had a recurring role on Law and Order for years, and you know, then when he and I talked, he had this stage role of a lifetime and this revival of a great play from the 1970s called Streamers by David Rabe. But you know, the takeaway for listeners is, you know, an actor getting up on stage is doing something every night that horrifies so many of us. And that's, you know, he's standing up there and putting himself out there in public.
Bearing your soul is really what you're doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. And, you know, we've all heard these stories about, you know, if you're going to give a speech, well, you know, picture everybody in the audience in their pajamas or something like that. And, you know, that's a clever thing, but it doesn't go far enough for most people. And what this actor told me is that the key is to be totally present. And for him, when he's on stage in this role, he is that character. In this case, you know, an army sergeant. I mean, he is completely that character. So if he flubs a line, if he stumbles on a word here and there, if he hears a ruffle in the audience, it doesn't matter because he's no longer himself. He's that actor. And when it comes to people, you know, getting up there and giving a big business presentation, or if maybe they're a salesperson and they're going in to pitch a new account, a giant account, the problem most people encounter is they start to think, you know, oh boy, I remember all the times in the past when I failed. You know, I remember all the times when I wasn't quite, you know, up to the task. I wasn't quite good enough. And that's what really inhibits them. They're not present. They're looking at that audience as something threatening, as opposed to, you know, just a bunch of people who are listening to what they have to say.
And who really, most of the people in the audience really want them to do well, because they're there to listen to what they have to say. And you're right. I think often it's so easy to go back into that museum of what I didn't do well and when I didn't do it well, instead of to focus on, wait a minute, I'm really prepared for this. I'm really passionate about this. I really care about the message. I really don't need these notes, because this is something that I already know intrinsically within myself. I think it's so much easier to let ourselves sort of slip to those negative places.
Yeah, and chances are, I mean, the person up there on the stage giving the presentation forgets that, you know, he or she is the expert at that moment. Yeah, and he or she knows more than the people in the audience. And none of us want to sit in the audience and see somebody, you know, just stumble and mumble and flub something, because you think, oh, God, this is just painful. Yeah. And, you know, our natural empathy goes out to that person.
All right, let's do number five. Let's talk about fear and desire, because we've sort of segued into fear right here anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first four traits are really, you know, what I call micro traits, and we can all sort of, you know, use them, and they help us all to be better under pressure. The fifth is more of a macro trait, and I talk about it specifically in regards to entrepreneurs, because we have so many examples out there of entrepreneurs who have a great idea. You know, they have this desire to do well, and many of them do. I mean, they start to see this idea build. But without a healthy dose of fear, the fear that says, you know, if I don't stay focused, if I'm not disciplined, if I don't adapt, if I'm not present, I could lose all of this. They can get into a lot of trouble. And we can kind of go through the past, you know, 5-10 years of one, you know, corporate failure after another, from, you know, WorldCom to Enron to HealthSouth to, you know, Lehman Brothers very recently. You know, all of these companies fail because, you know, Countrywide was another great one. You know, the desire for success outpaced, you know, a healthy bit of fear that says, okay, let me, you know, make sure everything is in check. And I talk about it in the book with a very nice conversation I had with Bernie Marcus, one of the founders of the Home Depot. And, you know, he founded the Home Depot when he was 49. He had just been fired from his previous job. He had a wife and several kids to support. And he said, oh, God, what am I going to do now? And so intrinsically, he had that bit of fear, but he had this desire for success. But he never forgot what could go wrong. And that's why early on they named their management style Running Scared.
Which is perfect. That's great.
Yeah.
Paul, you and I could talk for another hour. Okay. Oh, we could.
Why not? Let's do
it. Yeah, I know. I'm afraid we'd lose our listeners. The book is just, it's so interesting, because you have so many people that you have spoken with and so many great examples that our listeners would be able to identify with immediately. If you could leave the listener with one takeaway in the palm of their hand from the book, what would it be, Paul?
I'd say that, you know, anybody can become clutch. Anybody can become better under pressure in an area that they really care about. And it's not necessarily going to be easy, but it can be done with work. And I'll end with one last story, and that's this fellow I talked to for the book. His name's Tony Alvarez, and he's works in finance, but he's very successful at what he does in business. But his hobby, his love, was bowling. And he bowled a lot. You know, he took his wife along with him, took his friends along with him. Anyone who'd go with him, they'd bowl. And a couple years ago, he had rolled 11 strikes. Now, this means one more, and he bowls 300, a perfect game. And he tells this story in which, you know, he realizes he's bowled 11 strikes, but so does everybody else in the bowling alley.
Oh, no.
The lights go down.
Oh, no.
Everybody stops bowling. They all look at poor Tony Alvarez.
The spotlight comes on.
Absolutely. He, of course, then looks around and says, oh, no, everybody's looking at me. Well, you can probably imagine what happened. He rolls a ball, and it kind of, you know, wobbles down there and hits one pin and goes into the gutter. Doesn't make it. All the lights come on. He sits down. His wife consoles him. Says, you know, you got 11. That's pretty good. Well, he sticks at it because it's his passion. And, you know, a couple months later, same situation. 11 strikes, one more. What's going to happen? Well, this time he says, I'm not going to pay attention to everything around me. I'm just going to focus on my mechanics. I'm going to focus on my mechanics. I'm going to throw one more strike. Well, he does this, and I think this time he hits 5 or 6 pins. So he does better, but he still fails. Well, he's all but given up on the notion of bowling a 300 game until, last year he's in this situation one last time. And he is so, you know, he was so frustrated by the first two, chances at bowling a 300 game that he just says to himself on this third try, he says, you know what? Every other time today, I've just looked at that dot on the alley, and I've rolled the ball over the dot. That's all I've done, and I've hit 11 strikes, and it's worked fine. And so this time, on his third chance at a 300 game, that's all he does. He just looks at the dot, rolls the ball, and then he watches. And it goes slowly down the lane, rolling over and over and over. Boom. 12th strike, 300 game.
All right.
And that's clutch. That's the ability to do what you can do under normal circumstances, 11 strikes, under extreme pressure, that final strike to bowl a 300 game.
Paul, you are absolutely fascinating. The book is terrific. Thank you so much for taking time out of what I know is a really busy schedule to be my guest today on Inside the Writer's Cafe.